Chapter 59. Poisoners. One of the more enduring myths of criminology is that poison is the favourite weapon of the female criminal. All you have to do to disprove that is to glance down a representative list of female killers. Charlotte Corday, Catherine Hayes, Kate Webster, Lizzie Borden, Ruth Snyder, Mariah Manning, Ruth Ellis, most of whom used axes or knives. It's true that a similar list could be drawn up to include Lucrezia Borgia, Marie Lafargue, Madeleine Smith, Adelaide Bartlett, but this proves no more than that women have used poison as often as men. Poison is not the prerogative of either sex, but the very fact that there is such a myth provides a key to the mentality of the poisoner. A surprisingly high proportion of poisoners are daydreamers, fantasists, capable of telling splendid, elaborate lies to other people and to themselves. They would shrink from using anything as crude as a knife or a revolver. In short, poisoners usually have a touch of the artistic temperament. And the artistic temperament has more than a touch of the feminine, as Oscar Wilde showed in his essay on the 19th century poisoner Thomas Wainwright, Pen, Pencil and Poison. Examine the above list of female poisoners and another interesting aspect becomes apparent. The last four names on it were acquitted, although most students of crime would agree that they were probably guilty. Marie Lafargue, a fantasist if ever there was one, was very nearly acquitted. There's something oddly practical about these daydreamers. They get away with it. And what of the other name on the list, the most notorious poisoner of them all, the woman whose name has become synonymous with evil and murder? Well, oddly enough, this is another example of myth-making. Poor Lucrezia Borgia almost certainly never killed anybody, and she was anything but a murderess by nature. A gentle, rather weak-willed girl with the temperament of a good housewife, her chief claim to fame is that she was the sister and mistress of one of the deadliest men in history, Cesare Borgia. It was Cesare who was the master poisoner, and who is one of the most interesting examples of the criminal temperament since the Emperor Caligula, AD 37-41. Lucrezia and Cesare Borgia were the bastards of a cardinal and a courtesan. The cardinal, who later became Pope Alexander VI, was Roderigo Borgia. He was rich, powerful, easygoing, and he kept his mistress, Venozza Catane, in style in a palazzo. Venozza bore him five children. Of these, Lucrezia, the youngest, was born in 1480. Of the sons, Juan inherited his father's carefree temperament, but from the beginning, Cesare was violent and headstrong. Handsome, charming, vital and energetic, he had the spoilt child's compulsion to have his own way in everything. He was very definitely a high-dominance male, and Lucrezia, with her pretty oval face and slightly receding chin, was very much a medium-dominance female. This is, of course, the classic combination for producing crime. Snyder and Gray, Fernandez and Beck, Brady and Hindley are all examples of this explosive mixture of the dominator and the dominated. Lucrezia seemed made to be dominated, and she adored both her brothers, particularly Cesare. She probably lost her virginity to him before she reached her teens. Cesare was the sort of person who needed frequent sexual conquests, not so much out of sensuality as a desire to prove his power and potency. There are plenty of such despots in the history of crime, men who have an insane compulsion to have their way in absolutely everything, and who can't bear to be crossed in the slightest thing. Most of them, however, have to compromise with reality to some extent. They behave perfectly normally with the world at large and take out their delusions of grandeur on their wives and families. Cesare Borgia is an interesting example because he was in a position where he could put his fantasies of godlike power into action. He set out to sleep with every woman who attracted him, whether it was his sister or the wife of his younger brother. When he captured a town, he had 40 of its prettiest virgins sent to him to deflower. When invading Swiss soldiers looted his mother's house, he captured them and had them tortured to death. Later, he spent some time at the French court, where he suffered slights and humiliations. When he returned to Italy, he had most of the servants who had witnessed his humiliations murdered so that they couldn't mention what they had seen. The slightest frustration drove him to murder. His father seemed to prefer his brother Juan to himself. Accordingly, Cesare had Juan murdered and his body thrown into the Tiber. When Lucrezia married Alfonso of Aragon, on her father's orders, Cesare was so frantic with jealousy that he had Alfonso killed. When Cesare called on her at her castle a few months later, Lucrezia, in spite of her grief, welcomed him and probably slept with him. Her first child was almost certainly Cesare's. Cesare was an adept in the use of poisons. Some of them could make the victim die a lingering death, making his hair and teeth fall out. Others could kill immediately, with all the symptoms of a stroke or a heart attack. It's satisfactory to record that his downfall came through poison. Cesare and his father, the Pope, were invited to dine with a cardinal, Adriano de Corneto. They fell violently ill after the banquet. So did the cardinal, but that was probably political wisdom. The Pope died, and Cesare, who believed himself to be invincible and invulnerable, suddenly saw his castle of fantasy collapse. His troops deserted him. He was made prisoner by the new Pope. He fled to Spain and was imprisoned for his brother's murder. He escaped and joined a small army belonging to his brother-in-law. In a minor skirmish, he was seriously wounded, stripped, and left to die. He was 32 years old and had been responsible for dozens of murders. His sister, Lucrezia, married again, became famous for her kindness and her piety, and lived happily ever after, or at least for 11 years until she was 39. It's ironic that this gentle, affectionate girl should have become known as one of the great poisoners of history, when there's no evidence to suggest that she ever harmed anyone except possibly herself. Cesare Borgia dispensed death by many other means besides poison. He also had his enemies strangled, stabbed, and hacked to pieces. And yet, in a sense, he remains the archetypal poisoner. His portraits don't show an obvious evil ruffian. They depict a dreamer with an intelligent face. He loved art. He was a patron of Leonardo and Raphael. He believed, as his sister and his mother had done, that he could become a master of Italy, perhaps of the world. It was fantasy. He didn't have the realism of his namesake, Julius Caesar. His military successes were due to the backing of his father as much as to his own good generalship. Everybody at one stage in their development would like to impose their will upon the world. Everybody would like to see their enemies humiliated, their loyal friends rewarded. But most of us have to come to terms with a world in which this is not possible. If we learn to adjust well, we become decent, complex, mature human beings. Children don't want to adjust. As Freud points out, a child with infinite power would quickly destroy the world in a rage. Criminals are basically people who fail to come to terms with this reality. Although they know that they can't make the world obey their will, they still try to cheat it in minor ways, to steal what it refuses to give. A man like Cesare Borgia never makes the slightest attempt to come to terms with reality right from the beginning. He had two people who adored him, his mother and his sister, and one who loved him self-indulgently, his father. And so, like a spoilt child, he was allowed to indulge his tantrums all his life. This was a tragedy, for he had the intelligence and the vitality to be a great man. But by the time he was 20, tantrums and violence had become such a habit that nothing could cure him. It was also a tragedy for the world that it had to put up with his monomania. Here, then, is the basic picture of the criminal, but especially the poisoner. For to kill by poison is perhaps the most childish of all criminal acts. It's an attempt to stay on good terms with the world while breaking its laws. At the same time, it's one of the cruelest forms of murder. Anyone who's ever had mild food poisoning knows how bad it can be, vomiting until you're exhausted, and then vomiting again, unable to think because even thinking makes you feel sick. The poisoner can inflict this because he, or she, has decided to ignore the victim, to pretend he is a mere object with no feelings. Nearly all the famous poisoners have been rather childish personalities, often delightful and charming, but fundamentally children, determined to get their own way by stealth. Lucrezia Borgia was innocent. The woman who deserves Lucrezia Borgia's reputation was another pampered aristocrat, Marie, the Marquise de Brinvilliers, who was executed in 1676. The eldest of five children, she was the daughter of a councillor of state and treasurer of France. Like Cesare Borgia, she was eye-catching and charming, and like Cesare, and like all highly dominant women, she was a sexual experimenter. She later admitted to having had sexual intercourse with her brothers while still a child. At 21, in 1651, she married Antoine de Brinvilliers, Baron de Noir, who turned out to be a gambler and a libertine. 8 years later, the Baron met a gambler and charming confidence man named Saint Croix, who soon became Marie's lover. The Baron didn't object to this liaison, but Marie's father did. He had Saint Croix arrested and thrown into the Bastille. There, Saint Croix met an expert in poisons named Exili, and he became his pupil and disciple. Released from prison after 6 months, he and Marie decided that the quickest way to lay their hands on a fortune would be to poison Marie's father. It was here that Marie revealed the typical dissociation of the poisoner. She visited hospitals giving poisoned fruit to the patients to see whether the poison could be detected at an autopsy. It couldn't. Almost no poison could be at that date. And then Marie went to stay with her father, and he fell ill. She nursed him with apparent devotion for 8 months until he died. When she had inherited his fortune, she took a series of lovers. She resembled Cesare Borgia in another way. She couldn't bear to be crossed. When a creditor had one of her houses sold to pay a debt, she set it on fire. The following year, 1667, she devoted to poisoning her two brothers. But her success made her careless. She revealed her plans to her lovers, who were more squeamish than she was. Saint Croix, for example, blackmailed her. Another lover, the tutor of her children, tried to dissuade her from further murders, and so became a prime target himself. He survived several attempts on his life. She now decided to poison her husband so that she could marry Saint Croix. But Saint Croix, wisely, didn't want her. Whenever her husband fell ill, he rapidly administered antidotes. Finally, Marie met her downfall. Saint Croix died, presumably of natural causes, and Marie's first thought was for the box containing her letters to him, with which he had been blackmailing her. Her concern was not misplaced. When the box was opened, orders for her arrest went out immediately, and one confederate was broken alive on the wheel. She then fled to the Netherlands, entered a convent, and managed to avoid arrest for 3 years. At last, though, the law caught up with her. Her confessions were so frank and sensational that they had to be printed in Latin. After a trial lasting nearly 3 months, she went to the block. Her body was burned and the ashes scattered. The pattern should by now be clear. Not all poisoners have dominant personalities, but the element of fantasy and daydreaming seems common to most. Perhaps the most celebrated single case in the history of poisoning is that of Marie Lafargue. Marie poisoned her husband with arsenic in 1840, and the case is of interest to criminologists chiefly because it's one of the earliest cases in which forensic toxicology played a major part. An English chemist, Marsh, had discovered that if arsenic, or anything containing it, is put into sulfuric acid and zinc is added, a gas called arsine is formed. Then, if a narrow jet of this gas is burned and a cold porcelain dish is placed in the flame, the arsenic is deposited upon the dish. It was this that caused Marie's undoing and led to her sentence for life imprisonment. But the real fascination of the case is the personality of Marie Lafargue. A spoilt, rather pretty young girl, brought up at an expensive private school with the daughters of aristocrats, but without any large fortune of her own. She was pleased, therefore, when a coarse farmer and ironmaster, Charles Lafargue, approached her through a matrimonial agency. Although she disliked her suitor, she accepted him because she thought he was a rich landowner and that she would be able to invite her friends to stay at their chateau. When she discovered that the chateau was a decaying house and that the estate was a muddy village, she was at first heartbroken. But then she apparently made up her mind, quite coolly, to escape from the situation by poisoning her husband. In the months following the marriage, during which she faked affection for Lafargue, she carried out the poisoning with the callousness and deceit of a delinquent child. But several relatives of the doomed man saw her adding a white powder to his food. Even before his death, a medical expert called in to attend Lafargue said that he was dying of poison. Marie was duly arrested. Experts on poison clashed at her trial. The case became a cause célèbre, splitting France into two factions, her accusers and her sympathisers. For a time, it looked as though she would be acquitted, But the evidence of one of the great poison experts, Orfila, convicted her. She spent 10 years in prison, during which she corresponded with her most influential supporter, the novelist Alexandre Dumas, and eventually she died of tuberculosis at the age of 36. This same streak of immaturity and fantasy can be seen in most of the major English poisoning cases, from Dr. Pritchard and Madeline Smith to the Londoner Graham Young, the motiveless poisoner who in 1972 confessed to administering poison to his father, stepmother and to a school friend. One of the most celebrated of English poison mysteries is that of the death of Charles Bravo, who died of antimony poisoning at his house, the Priory, in Balham in South London in 1876. His pretty wife, Florence, was tried for his murder but finally acquitted. Yet in all the essentials described above, she had the temperament of a poisoner, the immaturity, the childish desire for her own way, the dreamy, romantic disposition. This doesn't prove her guilt, but, added to the other evidence, it makes it very likely. Possibly the oddest thing about poisoners is that there's something in them that keeps them permanently immature, so that they never grow up. This can be seen in America's classic poison case, that of Nanny Doss, sometimes known as Arsenic Annie, who continued her literally poisonous career for over 30 years and would probably have continued into old age if a doctor's suspicions had not been mercifully aroused. This fortunate event took place on October the 6th, 1954, when a 58-year-old man died in Tulsa, Oklahoma. He had been in hospital shortly before his death, suffering with stomach pains. He recovered and returned home with his wife, 49-year-old Nanny Doss. Nanny made him a large dish of stewed prunes, and he died the next day. His doctor, N.Z. Schwellbein, said that he couldn't imagine what had killed Samuel Doss, and that there ought to be an autopsy. Nanny agreed enthusiastically. Of course there should be. It might kill somebody else. When the police approached her sometime later and said that her husband's stomach had contained enough arsenic to eliminate 10 men, she looked amazed and distressed. How could such a thing happen? She gasped. Nanny was a plump, bespectacled woman who had obviously once been pretty. This was clear from the rather coy, soft manner, which seemed to suggest that she was younger and more desirable than she actually was. When asked if she had poisoned her husband, she stared at the police with wide open, innocent eyes and said in a shocked voice, "My conscience is clear." She talked openly and readily, so much so that the police had difficulty interrupting her. They began to wonder whether it was all a mistake. And then they changed their minds when they asked her what she knew about a certain Richard Morton. With her customary wide-eyed frankness, she declared that she had never heard the name. They then showed her 4 insurance policies, which indicated that Richard Morton had in fact been her previous husband and that she had benefited by about $1,500 from his death. She giggled coyly, "Well, I guess I wasn't telling the truth. I was married to him." It took days of patient questioning, of gently bringing her back to the point, to get her to admit that she had poisoned Samuel Doss and Richard Morton. When news of the case appeared in newspapers across the country, the Tulsa police were suddenly flooded with calls that made them realise that they had apprehended a mass murderess. Samuel Doss was apparently husband number 5, and 4 of the 5 had suffered mysterious deaths. Before Richard Morton, who died early in 1953, there had been Arlie Lanning, who was married to her from 1947 until 1952, when he died, suffering stomach pains, and Frank Harrelson, who died in 1945, the year he married Nanny. Harrelson's 2-year-old grandson had died a few months earlier in the same house. As Harrelson left the funeral, he had prophetically remarked, "I'll be the next." A young nephew of Arlie Lanning's had also expired in the same house of food poisoning just before Lanning's death. Further investigation revealed that Nanny's mother and 2 sisters had died with stomach pains when Nanny had been staying with them. And finally, detectives traced Nanny's first husband, George Fraser, whom she had married when she was 15. The union had been unhappy because Nanny had been wildly flirtatious and had periodically run off with other men. She explained to the officers that she had been searching for her dream man all her life and that her favourite reading was true romances. One day it was revealed George Fraser had come home to find 2 of his children dying on the floor. There was no inquest, and shortly afterwards Nanny went off with another lover, whereupon Fraser divorced her. Under questioning, Nanny's manner never changed. She remained smiling and candid, admitting to poisoning four husbands with an apologetic giggle, as if confessing to being a naughty little girl. She indignantly denied murdering anyone except the four husbands, but she gave way on this point when her mother's body was exhumed and found to be full of arsenic. Sentenced to life imprisonment, she died of leukaemia in 1965. Even as a convicted murderess, her manner never changed. Apparently nothing could make her admit that being responsible for the deaths of 11 people, four of them children, was at all wicked. Why had she committed murder? Because she was a romantic, with a high level of sexual drive. She felt she deserved more of life than boring, ordinary husbands.